You're listening to Honestly Mental, the podcast, and I'm your host, Erica Diaz. I'm a wife, a mama, a woman in leadership, but y'all, I'm a perfectly imperfect human. I have depression, PTSD, and generalized anxiety disorder, and I am figuring it out every single day. It's really been quite the journey, so this podcast aims to provide a raw and authentic approach to several issues surrounding mental health. Through the lens of our guests and I, we will provide insight into how we navigated our own challenges through honest and vulnerable conversation. We are building a community of individuals committed to changing the world, one conversation, one person at a time. We are raising awareness by destigmatizing mental health through continuing the conversation. We are providing hope and ultimately have a goal of saving the lives of those who may be feeling dark and alone. Hello and welcome to Honestly Mental, the podcast, and I'm your host, Erica Diaz. Today I'm joined by Shanna, who is a licensed mental health counselor in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Her therapeutic approach is marked by versatility, tailoring evidence-based practices to meet the unique needs of her clients. Shanna draws from a range of integrative and holistic modalities, but maintains a passion for the transformative power of movement and dance, which is what we'll be talking about today. Having grown up immersed in dance as a family-owned and operated small business, she witnessed firsthand the profound impact of these expressive modalities on mental and emotional well-being. I too was actually a part of your guys' dance studio when I was a young girl. Shanna's also deeply committed to a trauma-informed practice, recognizing the significance of creating a supportive space for healing. Her goal is to empower individuals on their journey towards self-discovery and resilience. When she's not at work, you can find her enjoying quality time solo traveling, drinking too much coffee, spoiling her nieces, and watching reruns of her favorite shows with her partner of 12 years. So welcome, Shanna. I am so excited to have you here with us today.
Erica, thank you so much. I'm honored to be here. I'm very excited.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about why you're here and sharing your story as it relates to mental wellness and body movement?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I had the fortunate experience of growing up in a dance studio. That took a lot of different forms over my childhood. At one point, my mom was teaching out of our living room. At a point, we had renovated a church, which is maybe the one that you were a part. Did you dance with us when we were at the church?
I think I was actually at the school, I felt like, but maybe I'm making that up.
That was another one. My mom would teach out of what is now, I think, the ECC, but it was the junior high, Flushing Junior High. She did community dance when we were there. So it looked like a lot of different things, but it was always present in my life. It was the family business. It was my daycare. It was my social life. And just played a huge role in my understanding of myself and how I showed up in the world. Simultaneously, you know, as a kid, unbeknownst to my parents, I was experiencing a lot of trauma from who was a Sunday school teacher and a close friend of the family at the time. And that can feel a little heavy to kind of talk about, but, the reality is that I was experiencing two very different worlds, two very different, deep pain, emotional trauma, sexual trauma, and then showing up in spaces where that was unknown. It was very hidden. It was very secret. And trying to show up and figure out who these two different sides of myself was. So I experienced a lot of, okay, she's showing up as this bubbly, smiley, on stage kid. But then the other part that was occurring was a lot of emotional tantrums, a lot of like lashing out.
Yeah.
My mom would talk about, I was like, I had a switch, you know, and there were times where I was just a really dark and upset kid and she couldn't understand why. And I would beg her to stay in bed with me long past when it would, you know, be normal for a child to want that. And I was I didn't have words for it. It wasn't like I think what was unique maybe is that it wasn't like I was this person and then an event happened and then I moved forward figuring out who this new person was. My earliest memories, I was being groomed. So there wasn't a before. It was just me. Yeah. And not having that language meant that there was going to be a lot that was coming up for me. But my saving grace, what, and I didn't realize it at the time, was dance. It was what I was able to express, what emotions that I didn't have words for that I could let out. And so ever since then, I've just become very passionate about people. I think that therapy is very cognitive and that can be a healing process in and of itself to talk about things, but our bodies carry so much feeling and emotion and wisdom and, you know, pain and joy that without also integrating our bodies as part of the therapeutic experience, we're missing a whole side of ourselves. My whole work has kind of led me towards, hey, how do we integrate these things? And can we bring the body into the therapeutic space?
Yeah. And Harvard Health has a blog. And one of the things that they say is that your mind and body are intimately connected, right? And while your brain is the master control system for your body movement, the way you move can affect the way you think and feel. So that tracks, right? As far as you being a young girl without having the language, but then having the space to be able to move your body. Obviously, I'm sure you still had to work through healing as you got older and became an adult and then doing what you do. But I just think that it's interesting when you think about it that, you know, those two are so closely connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Yeah. And I think that the beautiful thing about some of these somatic and specifically dance is there's never a lot of times in therapy, clients want to know how to not feel a feeling, right? Like, how do I not feel anymore? Which is understandable. A lot of people are feeling a lot of pain, but there's something about having a space where you just get to express it. There's no, don't feel this or feel something different. And through expressing it, much like that study you referenced, that's when things shift. That's when there's like now I have a new emotion. It's almost like making energetic room for new emotions. And yeah, that piece is huge.
And you hit on something too that I think is important about pain and just emotions that individuals are feeling, right? That, you know, I lost my train of thought here, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I was going to say that pain and different emotions that one can experience are not bad, right? So yeah, you're right. Like we often, especially as adults and then young kids, without having the language, even adults don't have language at times, right? But right. There's this almost opinion that emotions can be bad or certain, there's good emotions and bad emotions. But at the end of the day, there isn't one that is good or bad, and that's how you work through it and move through it and, you know, feel everything fully and then finding healthy ways to be able to truly move through the healing process. Right.
Right. Yeah. No, that is key. It's not good or bad. It's expected. Like our emotions, I don't know anyone in my work who hasn't been like, I've felt pain or I haven't felt pain or I haven't felt grief or right. It shows up in different ways for different reasons, but they're usually messengers. There's something that needs tending to, there's something that needs to be expressed. And that is a really human thing. And the less we kind of restrict ourselves, you know, the example I used earlier of the client who says, I don't want to feel this anymore. My immediate guttural response is, well, that's why it's sticking around. It's almost right. You're not feeling it. You're trying to make it logical. You're avoiding it. You're distracting yourself from it. And those are also tools, truthfully, that can, you know, avoidance, distraction, those can play a role in our journeys. But when we actually take the steps to, okay, I feel this like pit in my stomach. How do I want to move with that? How do I want to breathe into that? How do I, like, if we actually let ourselves feel the thing, that gives it permission to be released, right?
And it also is a feeling in the body, as you've just explained too. Is it a pit in your stomach? Is it a headache? Is it, you know, a pain somewhere? And to me, that's something that this is moving my body is newer. I've just, you know, I was an athlete in high school to an extent, but I've never been one to just be like, oh, I'm going to work out today, or I want to go dance. I'm really trying to get into a yoga practice and I'm not doing a good job at it, but it's one of those things that, you know, your emotions are more than just your thought. And so even for me, I'm in this journey early on of figuring out, oh, okay, I'm feeling a certain way. What, maybe it's anger. And then really like looking inside my body and saying, where am I feeling that anger? And as you said, breathing into it or working it out. Mm-hmm. It's a new journey for me, but it's really wild that it's more than just a thought. And you really have to pay attention to the visceral reactions within your body to work through them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you mentioning kind of your experience of being an athlete also makes me think of a lot of people kind of have complicated relationships with movement, right? There was a sense of, there was a goal, there was an outcome, there was a competition, there was a, that can all be, there's a place for that, right? But I think that a lot of times we move into this idea of once we get maybe a little older and we don't have as much structure around how we move, and it becomes chore. It becomes, you know, something to check off our to-do list. Like you even said, I'm not doing a good job with my yoga practice. And I was like, there's no pass fail. Like here's no like good
right,
job.
Right.
Right. And so a lot of times working through that's sometimes the cognitive piece that I work with too is, all right, what is, how have we perceived movement? How do we engage in a relationship with our bodies that allows us to be playful rather than, cause I mean, even dance, I mean, you've seen dance moms or maybe,
yeah.
Like the competition that can show up, something as brilliant and beautiful as movement that I think can be so healing can also be taken to an extreme where it actually has people disconnecting their minds and bodies and sacrificing that to this idea of performance, right? And that's important to note too, because I think that when we're talking about our relationship to movement, it's important to kind of look at yourself or work with your own, you know, therapist around what was my perception? How did I view movement? And how is that showing up today that maybe is no longer serving me? And that can look like a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's making me look introspectively on how I even feel about movement. I don't know that I've tackled that or what my own perceptions are. And then it's huge that you mention, you know, the competitive side of it, because you're right, it's an end goal. And I can see how that could be a distraction or its own kind of challenges later on. And almost takes away from the healing that movement and regular exercise can give you. I know, you know, for example, the same Harvard article talks about how regular aerobic exercise can help reduce anxiety, mm-hmm. that helps your brain's fight or flight system become less reactive. And so, even, you know, just like psychological changes when they experience fear, like a rapid heartbeat, through regular exercise, you can develop a higher tolerance for those types of systems or symptoms, right? And so it's just goes to show that really intimately getting to know your own body is hugely impactful as it relates to movement, healing, and working through whatever it is you could be dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's one of those things where people, you know, at one point, so the recommended, right, amount of exercise, and this is, people have asked me this before, is 150 minutes a week of moderate intensity exercise, right? That's a great piece of information. That's a great point of data for us, but it's not the whole picture, because if we're really thinking about movement as a relationship to our bodies and our emotions and our expression and our humanity, then any other relationship in your life, right? If you, you know, your husband, your kids, if you were like, well, it's been 150 minutes, we're done. Like that is, that is where that is. Or if you move into, well, we've only had 130 minutes. So you have to sit down right now and have 20 minutes of a relationship, right? So I think that sometimes, especially in today's world, in the land of information, right? We can get very technical about things. We want to know the exact system or the points that I'm supposed to hit to be able to improve or to move through certain things. But if we're really building a relationship, there are going to be times when you're feeling that sense of like, oh, I actually need a little healthy competition in my life. That feels good. That feels playful. That feels fun. I really like watching myself improve on this, you know, certain metric of physical activity.
Yeah.
But there's going to be other times where you're like, I think I just want to like take a walk and breathe deep, or I think I need a little more rest this week. Or I think, you know, relationships are dynamic, and our relationship to our bodies and therefore to movement should be no different. They're going to be dynamic. They're going to have, you know, highs and lows. And I think when we get into a place of, am I meeting the metric? Am I checking this off my list? Am I doing this for this thing? It can get really dicey for people, and people can get very rigid around it.
Well, and that's where you get into that pass or fail mentality. I'm just thinking about like, there's almost a disconnect if you think about the, like going to your regular general practitioner and seeing your physician, and it's the standard, well, how much are you exercising? It's part of their, you know, standard script, if you will, of, well, okay, you should be exercising about 30 minutes a day of moderate exercise, et cetera. I know I take that as, okay, yep, I know what you're going to tell me, but it's now another chore, as you mentioned earlier. And so it goes back to that perception and relationship with movement, at least for me, where I'm like, I need to really revisit that and be thoughtful about how I'm moving my body and why I need to move it at a certain point, rather than just checking the box because my doctor, not my therapist, you know, is saying you should move your body 30 minutes a day.
Right. Because I mean, and they are, you're seeing them. I mean, if it's like my primary care, I'm seeing them for like an hour, maybe once or twice a year.
Yes.
And they are not in my world. They are not showing up with me every week. They don't know what that, you know, that looks like, my, you know, and they, don't get me wrong, I think that doctors are also part of a system that, you know, I too find myself feeling restricted by systems of insurance and how we approach medical care in our here. But I do think that, to your point of it not being a chore, sometimes when I hear people question certain things, so I'll give the example of a year ago or so, I was working with a client who one of their kind of goals was to drink more water. And if they, you know, that's such a kind of, it was a starting place. It felt simple enough, right? But yeah, every time they would come in, if they hadn't met their ideal goal, there would be a lot of like shame and judgment, right? It was, I need to be better about that. I'm not doing that. I'm, you know, I know that. I'm, what's kind of a, what is wrong with me happening in their head. And at one point I asked them, I was like, when you were drinking more water, did it feel better? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, okay. So, and it, but it was in a way where it was like, it's no longer I'm failing. It was, the first question was, I felt better. when I did, like, there was a gentleness. Yeah. It was like that's why I'm doing it. Not because I want to be some machine that gets a certain amount of ounces of water a day. I'm doing it because, that felt gentle. That felt kind. That felt good. I moved more. The benefits are of drinking water. But just shifting how we like talk to ourselves or think about some of these things that are otherwise, yes, very good for us, right? No one's going to argue. Most of us could probably get a little more movement and water in our lives.
I know I can.
Coffee drinker here, right? but it's no longer about just knowing that. It's about how you interact with that information in a kind and gentle way that makes it applicable to you. Because anyone that's like, you're failing at this, most of us are going to resist that. Most of us are going to feel judged by that or shame. And those are terrible motivators. So yeah, I agree with you.
And speaking of terrible motivators, let's not forget the societal pressures. Even in the water example, I don't drink enough water, but I don't really have a relationship with it where I'm like, I need to drink X amount. Mm-hmm. And kudos to everyone who is working on that. But how often on my Instagram, and now it's going to blow up crazy, do I see different massive thermoses of like, okay, if you drink this, then oh, all right, you're like a quarter of the way there, you know? And it's just another, maybe that's a silly example just from a water perspective, but the societal pressures of what something like that is supposed to look like also play into that judgment and shame that can be associated with quote unquote failing at something. And it's really changing and reframing that in your mind and looking at why you're doing it and really understanding in that case, you know, well, I felt good when I drank more water and I could move more. That should be the focus, but it's not always easy to get there with all of these external, you know, sources of information that are available these days to easily get to that point.
Yeah, that is. So this is also one of my favorite areas to navigate is one of the things that movement, specifically dance, provides me with is listening and being present for internal inputs. And what I mean by that is I feel like we have shifted, especially in, you know, the last couple generations. Oh my God, like I have external stimulus about what I should or should not do or should not think or how to improve or what is better. Or there are countless things that I can engage with that can feel maybe in the moment. I've certainly been guilty of this where I'm like, oh, this is making me feel productive. I'm going to create a plan around this. And not realizing that at no point have I checked inward. At no point has there been like a sense of like, does this land for me? Does this? And that has been a huge piece for because I wasn't dancing for several years. And reintroducing dance has kind of reaffirmed that for me because when I dance, whether it's at home in my living room or a class that I take at a great studio here in Grand Rapids, it is me and music, and it's just my internal cues. It's me following maybe choreography that I'm learning, but there's nothing external that's telling me to shift or be different. It's all present, right? And that I think to your point of like, we keep seeing what we should be doing. And so our thoughts have turned from this feels good, this feels riveting, I like this, I don't like this, into this person does this, and this person does this, and that's a really cute water bottle. Maybe that water bottle is what will make me drink it. Right? I can't be the only one with 36 water bottles thinking that they're all going to, you know, make me drink more water. But, and we've just attached to this water example at this point, and that's great. But, but I do think that there's this need for that movement can provide, whether it's walking, whether it's weightlifting, whether it's dance, yoga, there is a sense of, okay, if I'm moving my body in any sincere way, I'm probably tuned in more internally than I am externally.
You know, and that kind of goes to, I'm curious about your thoughts on this. And, you know, I have like, what level of exercise is required to have certain benefits? And the reason I'm curious as to what your answer is going to be is, I think that's probably one of those metrics that we inadvertently put on something like moving our bodies. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to kind of respond to that, like, question. I'm sure for those at home are like, okay, so we're talking about body movement and I get it, but what level of exercise do I need to have to reap benefits from it? So would love for you to reflect on that and kind of share your thoughts mm-hmm. for anyone thinking, like, again, that 30 minute example comes into mind and what it has to be.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I love the gray area of pretty much everything, which makes me insufferable at times, but this is one of those areas where the truth is that we have data, right? There are people way smarter than me that have conducted studies and have determined, I think this is the NHS, has determined that it's 150 minutes a week of moderately intense exercise to 75 minutes a week of intense exercise, right? So however, you know, people want to take that in and split that up, right? Yeah. That is a helpful metric. In my world, it is not the whole picture. It is, if that metric, if when I'm engaging somebody in how do we incorporate more movement and they get fixated on that number, then that number is no longer helpful. If I am working with people and that number becomes aspiring and they're playing with it and they're like, yeah, I nailed it and I do feel better, or this week was a, then that number is helpful. That number gets to be kind of a tool, right? I think what we risk is applying broad strokes to individuals and individuals, right? So how I talk about a goal for one client is going to look very different. A client with three kids who is also working full time and has, you know, a desk job and is really hard on themselves and really kind of their internal dialogue is about everything they're not doing. The first thing I'm going to do is we're going to look at how we are speaking to ourselves and how we're tuning into what actually feels good, because that might mean that that individual starts walking on lunch breaks for 5 minutes and then that is like revolutionary for them, right? Yeah. As opposed to somebody who is exercising for 2 hours every single day and is still feeling disassociated and disconnected from their bodies, I'm going to figure out how to get them to sit still. And I'm going to figure out how to get them to breathe into some of the areas that hurt. Because now the same tool, movement, one person is using it to kind of open themselves up and heal something. Another person is using it to disconnect themselves, to make it all about the metrics, to make it all about the goals, and both people are suffering from a loss of integration and embodiment as I see it. So that's a very long-winded way to answer your question of, we have this data from the NHS that talks about what is a healthy goal for the average adult, I think age like 18 to 65 or something. And we also know that, my goodness, people are varied, and my goodness, we are complex, and my goodness, we are needing different things at different seasons in our life. And that gets to be allowed as well. So that's why I'm insufferable, because then your listeners are like, well, geez, lady, like that's not helpful, right? But this is more to that idea of, how, like, where am I at? Like, if I take a realistic look at my movement and how I talk to myself about it and what I use it for, if I'm using it for playfulness, integration, expression, healing, or am I using it as some sort of tool of like punishment and to fit a certain aesthetic or metric? And if I'm realistic about where I'm at, what does it look like to kind of come back to that nuanced gray area where I'm breathing a little bit easier?
Yeah, no, I think that was a perfect answer, because those, you know, the NHS and any of the, you know, statistical data that's out there, it is very much in many ways, I mean, I suppose not always, but in many cases, the broad stroke, you know, the broad brush across everybody and not taking into consideration the individualized approach that is needed for me, for you, you know, it's one of those things that it can be helpful, but can also be, I don't want to say it could be harmful, for those that don't have a great inner monologue in what they're telling themselves. And, you know, that it goes back to that failure, and whatnot. So I think for me, it was a really good answer about why it's important to, one, reflect on your relationship with your body as a starting point. And then, you know, what does movement look like for you? And why are you doing it, or why are you not? You know, and getting to a place of a more healthy relationship with what that movement is and why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the know thyself, right? Like the self-awareness piece around what is fueling this? What is the motivation? What am I saying to myself? I mean, the exact same, two people can be doing the exact same exercise regimen and be having completely different results insofar as their mental health. Right. So, because that internal dialogue is still very important. So yeah, that nothing, if that for your listeners, if there are people where they're like, I have just been trying to work off I need to be doing this and I'm not, and I'm shaming myself for not, that is a piece of that is data that is equally as important as what the NHS put out for you specifically. Yeah. That is a great piece of data. Maybe consider bringing that data to a counselor or a therapist or somebody that can help you walk through it, or journaling, right? If that's not an option either, but having that know thyself metric and seeing that it's just as, if not more, on an individual level valuable, then we get to integrate that with the, okay, yeah, 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. Let me see what that looks like for me. But that metric needs to be met with your own individual metric of where you're at and what is motivating kind of your starting point.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about, you know, there's some benefits that I've already mentioned, such as, you know, making your fight or flight system less reactive. You know, we know that moving your body can influence the way you think and feel. So what are some other benefits from moving your body that one could realize by, you know, having a healthy relationship with movement?
Mm-hmm. Movement has such an impact, I mean, on everything you said, right? We know its impact on the physiological. We also know, have well-documented space for mental health benefits. I guess in a more maybe woo-woo spiritual space, I have personally seen within myself and also within clients, there is a way to use movement. We've talked about it as expression. We've talked about it as a relationship with your body and a starting point to understand yourself. Movement for me has been a way to shift my current areas where I feel stuck. So I can give you, you know, a personal example. I had stopped dancing when I went back to grad school, and I became very cognitive because that's what my program and profession tends to be, right? And I, like when I look back at that period in my life, and it was a couple years of, yes, I was working towards these goals and I was feeling all this stress and all of these physiological symptoms were also showing up. But there was also this heaviness and the sense of, I am not myself. And only within the last, I want to say maybe year and a half, where I started inviting movement back in a playful way. And when you, I personally think that playfulness is like the highest state of enlightenment, if you will. I think that when we can actually give ourselves permission to be playful with things, we're exhibiting kind of a wisdom that a lot of times we dismiss as we become adults, right? And so when I first tried to go back to movement, it was in the way that we're talking about, right? I was like, you know, my body was different. I felt different. I was trying to do things that before I had been able to do with ease and now I couldn't. And what showed up? Judgment, fear, shame. Mm-hmm. Like, and that like stripped me of my joy in these types of activities, which I'll be honest is mostly dance, but also I'm trying to play with other movement too. But and so I think that when I realized that, because I tried to go back and I felt really shut down and not by anyone, but by myself.
Yeah.
I got really shut down and I became really rigid and locked in. And at one point I was getting a massage, and this is a massage therapist that has worked with me for several years now. And she was basically like, girl, your ribs won't expand. Like your ribs are like, you're like a board. Like it was almost like I was physically showing up as unable of play or flexibility or breath or move. Like it was showing up physically. And so I left her that day and I journaled for a while. And I realized that what was missing was this aspect of like, girl, skip down like a street, or like skip until you burst into laughter because you look ridiculous. Like, you know, like go dance. And when you notice an area where you're like, oh, that I can't do that anymore right now, like find joy in that. Like, what does that mean? Like your body's like, oh girl, we have not, like, why are you trying to do the splits? This is not, we don't do this right now. And if I entered like playfulness and almost a sense of lightness with how I approached movement, spiritually, I shifted. My perception of myself, how I talked about my body, how I engaged with my body, not perfectly. Like, I'm not like, oh yeah, I did this and now no worries. But there is definitely, the more I introduce that element of it, the benefits are a deeper knowing, a deeper sense of self, a kindness, a compassion. Putting myself in a position to be uncomfortable has been such a growth curve, right? Which I think all of us put ourselves in uncomfortable situations, especially in a playful way. Our idea of what we're capable of starts to shift. And that to me has been one of the greatest things that I've seen for clients that I've worked with.
I love that. And you have mentioned more than once about the playfulness. And for me, that brings up really getting in touch with your inner child. And for somebody who has experienced trauma, or, you know, especially at a young age, you know, I think both of us are in a similar boat. It's one of those things that we've got to have fun and we've got to be connected to that inner child and let them come out and be playful. And sadly for me, I've got to work on that quite a bit. But hearing this conversation, I'm thinking about how I can look at movement more playfully. And I'm hopeful that it will help me find a regimen that will work and really kind of release some of the rigidity that I experience as well in my own life.
You want to know that I've never made that connection for myself? very good question. Like, yeah, no, I missed out on a lot of, and immediately like light bulbs, thank you. But to be playful is to know you're safe. Yeah. When we're playful with something, it's like we have like the right to show up in a, like, think about the people that you are the goofiest with. They're not the person that is an acquaintance that you're not really quite sure how they feel about, right? Like at its most basic level, we're the goofiest with the friends that we've had since middle school. And then like, yeah. Right, like, or the people we feel safest with. So I do think that there is an element of recognizing that playfulness is kind of a way to communicate to your own bones, so to speak, like, hey, it's okay. We don't gotta lock ourselves up. We don't have to, make everything okay for everyone else so that we can know we're safe. We can let loose. Things can feel like my hips can feel a little tight. That's okay. I still get to show up in this space. The weight that I'm lifting right now is not as much as whoever over there who's real swollen has been doing this for 26 years. That's okay. Like, I'm still like, I'm gonna, you know, smile and realize like I get to play with this movement and I get to have these goals in a very friendly and approachable way. That was a beautiful connection, Erica. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. No, I mean, therapist Erica Diaz over here. Just kidding. Not even
close. I have a few. I'll do that later. No.
I think that's where I'm at in my journey. And that's why I made the connection, because actually this really excites me, because I have been trying to do inner child work and, I realize this is a little off topic, but when I have done even meditation exercises or different things in therapy, trying to even envision my inner child, or, you know, scenarios where you look back at your past and you can kind of rescue your younger self in a way and rewrite some of that history, I've not been able to do it this far. So, I'm thinking that the connection to playfulness and body movement may open up a whole new world for me. So I'm pretty stoked about that.
That's amazing. You'll have to keep me updated on that. Cause I,
for sure.
I know I have a hard time with inner child work too. I mean, I've flat out like ghosted therapists before because they push, this was before this was years ago, but like that can be a very tender place to go when you've, you know, sustained pretty significant trauma at those ages. So I hope that introducing play creates more of a bridge for you for that.
For sure. And you mentioned, I mean, the tenderness around your inner child, it goes hand in hand with playfulness when you think about it. When you think about, like, I can look at my 3-year-old and how tender, well, I don't know if he's tender.
In his own way.
He's 3, he's 5. And his playfulness, that's inner child, it doesn't go away. It's just accessing it, right? And so you think about a young child, and definitely tenderness and playfulness are words that describe it. And so it's one of those things for me that, that's not been my experience. And so I'm really excited to have a new perspective on this, and hopefully we'll have some good results from getting in touch with my inner child. And then ultimately having more, I'm going to use the word success, but just more success in connecting with my body and moving it in a way that is beneficial for me. I have always looked at movement as even yoga a little bit. I was resistant at first, but the yoga that I do is restorative yoga. So it's very calming, relaxing. And I have found that I don't, care what other people in the room are doing. I don't, like, it is my time. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, movement is, I'm just like, ugh, mm-hmm. And so introducing the playful element to it, I think, is really going to help. And I think it will also help me open up my mind to what movement could look like, and not in the confines of, okay, here's a very specific yoga practice, or here's what a workout regimen looks like at a gym, mm-hmm. or I need to meet that 30 minutes of exercise every day, or whatever it is. I think it will certainly open up how I could look at options to get myself moving.
Mm-hmm. And I, you know, hearing you kind of express it, playfulness, connecting to an inner child, connecting to how you now currently experience movement. Anyone who has, and this for you too, anyone who has a toddler, one of my favorite exercise, because I used to teach dance to littles. And one of the best things you can do, because toddlers, right, I'm sure you've experienced, they exist in their bodies with reckless abandon. Like, it's very, like, they are very present in their bodies. They are very not afraid to, like, explore how different movement feels. And one of the things that is, that may be helpful as a tool, is to play follow the leader with your toddler. So this can include the whole family, or it can just be you and your kiddo, but play a song that they really like. And first you be the leader, and you're like, okay, we're marching like mom. And then, you know, maybe get your other older kids involved, and now they want to crawl on the floor like this. But ultimately, when your toddler gets to be the leader, they will introduce you to movement that you're like, that doesn't, that, and I mean, be safe, but like, you're like, like, they want to do like weird elephant walks, or they think that like throwing their arms up in the air and like running into the next room is the most amazing thing. And if you can bring yourself to mimic them, to truly treat them as like your movement coach, and have that playfulness and that interaction with your family, it can break up some things for people. Because I'm sure while it's difficult for you to get in touch with your inner child, you see your, like, that's very clear. You see your child as being this precious and whole, and, you know, if not wild, and, you know, having their own opinions, but you see them as fully embodied in so many ways, and you want to nurture that and tend to that. And sometimes allowing them to, and kids are all about this. They're like, oh my, because, you know, our toddlers, we're telling them what to do all day, every day, whether they listen or not. Yeah, but you're giving them an opportunity. They're like, I can make mom hop on one foot. Are you kidding me? Like, like, let's go. So allowing them that space can also be a pretty significant piece for parents who otherwise do struggle with, you know, what did my inner child need? What did I, how did I, you know, crave movement? And who better to learn that from than a child?
Yeah. And as you were talking through that, for some reason, I just started crying. I don't know why, but I think it's just like the simple nature of being a kid again. And what an amazing exercise to just consider, to be playful. One, what a fun experience for the whole family, but also to be able to, you know, get past some of the rigidity. And, you know, I think there's certainly no judgment in that situation, right? And it's just fun and loose and simple and still movement.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And that that is exactly how I would want movement to register for someone who's had significant trauma and who otherwise may have a complex relationship to their body in a way that you didn't ask for that. That's not your fault. So approaching movement in that way, where it's like, oh, this really is play, because it can be nothing else with a 3-year-old. Sometimes that's your entry point.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I will be playing Follow the Leader probably very soon in my life. And hopefully not crying through it, but hey, if I do, whatever. It'll be happy tears.
Listen, sometimes, and that's another, like, not to go off on another tangent, but that is when movement surfaces an emotion, that is a holy place for me personally. That is when I am in child's pose and I feel a surge and I want to like let out tears. It's like, what is it? Because that doesn't happen every time. Sometimes I'm in child's pose and I was like, this is great. Love this. Like, and then other times it's like, oh, there's something here. And that is where when we initially feel it, it's so tempting to stuff it down. But if you can be present with it and you can allow it and you can make room for it and you can invite it, a lot of times that's how we get unstuck.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's fabulous. I'm just thinking about how, if I'm playing follow the leader and I break down crying, how it then also just gives another opportunity for us to have conversation about emotion in our household with young kids, because that's important. You know, and so it's another place of vulnerability, that could show up unexpectedly maybe, but, just so sincerely and genuine, I think, it presents an opportunity for good dialogue too.
Absolutely. Yeah. And what an amazing gift, I think, for your kids. Because they know, like, I'm sure when your 3-year-old was mad, he didn't just like sit there and think of, he stomped, right? Like he yep. like stomped off, or he like, right. And we're trying to, show our kids, representation of healthy expression of emotions, right? Not to stifle it, not to weaponize it, right? But that middle space of, yeah, I'm feeling this thing, and like, yeah, we're mad. That's okay. How do I exist in this anger so that I can move past it and have the following actions be that is closest to my most authentic self? And that is that brilliant space that adults forget, because we kids are good at expressing it. And adults are good at not expressing it, but being like, oh, well, I'm just not going to be angry. And I'm just going to, you know, and so it's that middle space of, I feel it and I'm present with it and I express it appropriately. And then guess what? I get a bit of a release and I move forward in a way that's far more aligned than if I had suppressed it.
Yeah. Gosh, this has been such a good conversation. I knew it was going to be a good one because movement is just an area that I would like to be like working on. And so it's just been so insightful. What tips do you have, you know, to share about body movement and maybe even the motivation to get started? Like, what does that look like for somebody? We've talked a lot about the reflection and perception of where you are, you know, with your own body and, you know, probably thinking through what movement has felt like for you in the past or what it's brought up. Are you doing it as a chore? And so there's kind of this, I don't want to say a checklist, but there's this introspection that should occur with what movement looks like for you and your relationship with it. But outside of that initial part of your journey, what tips do you have about, you know, getting started?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the big things is, and how I know someone is going to go super cognitive, is if they are constantly in what we call like a preparedness, right? So they're okay. I've decided where the thing is, and I see that I have this relationship, and I need to work on this. And I'm guilty of this. I'm so guilty of preparing for the thing and not doing the thing. So sometimes with people, I will write in my office, I will, you know, ask them to just stand up and sit down and not think, right? Which sometimes people are like, what on earth? Like, why would I? But I think if we're really trying to use movement, there is that introspective piece. But right now, your listeners, if you're driving, please do not, if you're listening to this while driving, please wait. But if you are listening to this and you're at home, like do a quick jumping jack, or like stretch your arm like across and notice like what comes up, or shake. Our dogs do this. Our dogs model this beautifully. Whenever he's nervous or excited, it doesn't matter, he will like shake. Like he has this energetic, like, blah, 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 like,
yep.
I have to like move this through my body. Shake. Like what can I give myself permission to engage with my body instead of thinking about engaging with my body until it's like, you know, yes, there's the introspective piece, but I would almost argue to start with movement and then go journal. Then, okay. So like in this moment, if I'm just like shaking or I do a couple air squats or I like kick my feet up like a marching band leader, whatever kind of comes naturally, if I play a song and I just let myself move and shake and throw my arms around, however feels natural and good to you, and then be like, okay, did I feel ridiculous? Why? Did I feel good? Why, did I burst out into laughter because I do feel ridiculous? Like, because as soon as you do that, you are present with yourself. And I think that my tip when it comes to the motivation piece is to give yourself permission to just start, to just play the song you know you're going to rock out to, or, you know, like wiggle your butt a little bit or pull a Shakira move or like, yeah, whatever it needs to look like, because it will bring you so much quicker into the present than any amount of like cognitive processing.
Yeah, that's fair. And I'm rethinking this being on camera because I did a jumping jack when
you said it. You're an amazing, like you just immediately apply it. I love it.
I'm like, I'm going to do this right now. And yeah. I did. And let me tell you, I just felt goofy and fun and I'm going to play follow the leader this weekend. Like it's going to be amazing.
Yeah. You know what? That's another great point really quickly is if you notice after some movement, there is something more resistant, right? Like there's a sense of like, that was uncomfortable. Being okay, like making space for that too, because I think what sometimes we want to happen is this, we've been talking a lot about playfulness and I do think it's important, but if something, when I first went back to dance, it was a sense of like, I don't even recognize this body and I'm mad about it. And the temptation was to be like, you shouldn't feel mad about it. You should love your body. You're supposed to be fine with this. You're supposed to, you know, like you're a freaking therapist, Shanna, what are you doing? Right? That kind of pressure. And instead I was like, you know, I'm going to acknowledge that this feels upsetting and that this and yeah. that like create movement around that feeling. So to my point, it's just whatever shows up, that is what we want to move with, not against.
Yeah. Whatever shows up, let's move with it. And I think that is really great advice. You know, we're going to get ready to wrap up here, but one of the things that came up on a different episode that I would love your input on is, especially with your profession, mm-hmm. is, you know, finding a therapist, right? So we talked about this on a previous episode, and that can be one of the most daunting, scary, annoying, I don't know, name all the negative things, or even though I just said there's no good emotion or bad emotion, name all the things that generally are negative, right? And you're like, dang it, it's a lot. But mm-hmm. therapy, finding a therapist is so difficult, I feel like, because it's human to human bonding in a sense that a professional way, but you're not going to click with everybody. Right. Similar, you know, so whether it's friends or a therapist, you're not going to click with everybody. So right. I said, or suggested, you know, give a therapist a few sessions, 3 sessions or so. The first session is always like, I feel like in my experience, it's like the trauma dumping grounds. And so there's not a whole lot of work in that initial session and probably the next couple of sessions. So what do you think is an appropriate timeline mm-hmm. to stick with the therapist before you make a decision that it's not going to work out? Like, what does that look like? What advice do you even have on that topic?
Yeah. It's a great question because it is such a frustrating experience. I personally have been, you know, in therapy far longer than I've been a therapist. So I definitely understand that side of things and feeling like, that, you know, if I am working with this person, do I have to continue working with them, even if I feel like it's not clicking or, you know, there's some resistance coming up. And now on the other side of things, what I will say is that it is, not only is it okay, but it is such a gift to yourself if when you are connecting with a therapist, you address what's coming up. Right. So what I mean by that is, if you feel like, if you're like, I'm really nervous that this isn't the right fit, it can be such a difficult thing to say that to somebody because of all of our like social implications around that. But your therapist, you're seeking out a licensed therapist, is trained, is clinically trained to hear hard things. And so if the hard thing, I did an intake session with someone because, I mean, yeah, we're human. And that person was pretty much like, I don't think that we're a good fit. Like, you remind me of someone that I had a rough relationship with. And in the room, I'm like, oh my God, like, I'm this terrible person and what, right? But all of that, I am trained to sift through. And at the end of it, and I genuinely meant it, I said, I am so grateful that you were honest and felt like you could say that with me. Now, on the flip side of that, I think that there are times with therapists where maybe you don't feel comfortable saying that. Maybe they're not, therapists are as vast as as anyone else, right? Yep. In approach, in their personalities. It's always, I think, helpful if you can find a place that will do the group practice I work with, will set up 15-minute meet and greet calls. And that's always something you can ask for. So before you even get into the process of doing an intake or working through several sessions, getting them on the phone, being able to have a quick conversation and asking them, I always kind of recommend to people to ask therapists what, if there's been a time where they have worked with someone who is presenting with similar things to you, right? So maybe I'm going in and I have PTSD, you know, I have some anxiety, whatever's going on. Have you worked with somebody with these types of issues before? What did you do? What was your approach? And what was the outcome, right? And short of you know, telling you something that's going to break confidentiality, they can say, here's what I did. Here's how it looked on the other side, or how it was supportive or not supportive, or these were individual varying factors. And pretty quickly you can kind of get an idea of like, okay, did that approach resonate with me? Did how they talked about themselves make me feel confident? Did they seem honest and vulnerable? Maybe they say, you know what? I actually haven't worked a ton with that. Right? But here's how I would approach it. And you're like, yeah, okay. Like, do you get a sense that there's an authentic person on the other phone or on the other line? Because while there are obviously stories of like therapists, you know, being unethical or causing problems or, you know, most of us, all of my colleagues really want to help.
Yeah. Like,
really are there because we want to support people and we want to get them feeling better. And so if you are comfortable asking for that consultation call, being honest with them in the room, even saying, I'm nervous that this isn't a good fit, right? It's not the same thing as this isn't a good fit. It's I'm nervous and I'm not one to say that typically, or because chances are they also are sensing that, right? We do know that the clients that we're clicking with versus the ones that maybe we're struggling to kind of form rapport with. So the quicker you can get to that honest place, a lot quick. That's part of the work, you know?
Yeah. So. And I would have never thought to ask for like a meet and greet, and that's amazing. And it's so cool that your practice does that. Mm-hmm. And it makes a lot of sense because you can very quickly get a feel for whether or not you're going to click with somebody, you mm-hmm. know? And you can certainly try and with time you may realize it may not be immediate, but with time you may realize that it's not a good fit. Yeah. And I would encourage anyone, once you start feeling that way, you know, to start talking about it with your therapist or making a decision that it's not a right fit and knowing that that is okay. I love how you put it, that it's a gift you can give yourself, because I had a scenario where I had a psychiatrist and I was like, this isn't going to work,
yeah.
You know? And for the first time I had called and said, you know what, I do need to find somebody else. And there were some things that happened in the meeting that led me to that. Mm-hmm. But previously, past Erica, I would just ghost my therapist.
Yeah. I've ghosted a therapist. I'm not proud of it. It happened.
You know, like that's the easier way to just be like, yeah, this doesn't work. But what that meant for me in those moments is when I would ghost a therapist, I didn't immediately find another therapist because I was like, dang, it takes so much work.
Yeah.
So for anyone on the journey, you got to stick with it and know that you aren't going to click with everyone. It's not going to be a perfect match every single time. But when you find that match or the ability to be vulnerable, even in scenarios where you're like, I don't know if this is going to work out, it really, truly is such a gift because, you know, there's nothing better than getting to a place where you're working with your counselor and doing really deep, good work with one another. And that doesn't happen without that rapport and the trust with one another.
Yeah. Well, the therapeutic process is such a collaborative thing, right? Because it does require obviously the skills of the clinician, but oh my goodness, as clients, like what you bring is invaluable and is the most important piece for me personally, because I sit with somebody 1 hour a week. I need to know what is like, what's supportive, what's not supportive. And very often if there's nervousness or trepidation around that communication, that's also showing up in their outside life. You know, like if you can't tell the person that's there to hear the things like, hey, that like I tried this thing that you mentioned and I hated it, right? If you're people pleasing me, that's also therapeutic work to be able to say, hey, like the whole process is to support you. So if it's not supporting you, I am so grateful because I don't want to be wasting anyone's time. So, I certainly think that can be like, if you look at it that way, if you look at the, okay, sometime like I'm not clicking with this therapist and I'm struggling to know how to like not continue working with them. Ooh, that's work. Like that's part of like that process of understanding yourself and, navigating that. So it can actually be really, its own kind of healing journey in a way.
So people pleasers, listen to that, right? Like I am guilty of being a people pleaser, and that's probably why it was difficult for me in different times to raise my hand and say, this isn't a good fit. And then instead ghost people, which is awesome, but no, people pleasers, please. Like it's work even in that sense. And so, you know, let's stick with it. And, if you do, I'm confident that you'll be able to find a great therapist that will be able to help you work through whatever it is you're going through. And quite frankly, I mean, I just feel this way. I think therapy is good for everybody, whether or not you've experienced trauma, because as you mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, everybody experiences grief, everybody experiences loss and pain and all of these things that, it certainly doesn't hurt to have a licensed medical professional there along the journey with you who are, I mean, way smarter than me when it comes to sifting through whatever it is that's going on in my mind. Right. And it's another person to be able to help support you on your journey. So please don't people, please try not to. It's a hard habit to break.
Yeah, I can attest to that, girl. It truly is. Yeah. You don't have to worry about hurting our feelings. I guess we are people, like, but
yeah,
we're not in your, like, the whole idea is that is a space where I am not showing up and in my clients' lives and as somebody who has like a daily awareness of like interactions, right? I'm not going to go to their friend and be like, oh, she said this or that, or judge her in that capacity. When I'm working with somebody, I am a completely separate from their world outside of that specific space that helps them navigate through tough things. And that usually means they can say things that they would never say to anyone else. And then we can sit with that compassionately and honestly, and that's kind of its own healing process. So yes, do not be afraid of hurting our feelings. It is, we are trained to be honest with you and you be honest with us. And hopefully I wish everyone well in finding the right therapist. Cause I know that it can be daunting.
Yes. Well, Shanna, thank you so much for joining Honestly Mental. This has been a fabulous conversation. I imagine that I will have you back on other topics. So I'm thrilled for that as well. So just again, big thank you for your honesty and vulnerability, and was so happy to have you join today.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Erica. This is a brilliant project you're doing, and you're such a great voice for advocacy with mental health. So I appreciate you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for listening. If you could comment below, rate, and subscribe, I would be forever grateful. And feel free to share Honestly Mental, the podcast, with your network as well. Take care.